are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 10th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dave Weigel of the Washington Post on the 3M Plus Tuesday, as we've dubbed it. It's not its real name. About seven, what do we have? Seven primaries tonight? Why'd you make that face, Brendan? Six. Idaho, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, and Washington State. We will be doing live coverage tonight starting at about 7:45 p.m. Eastern. Also on the program, Sanders calls for free coronavirus vaccines. Biden makes it to a rally. He also says he'd veto Medicare for All if both a Democratic Senate and House passed it. All right. Circuit breaker hits Wall Street yesterday as coronavirus fears spread across the country. Trump proposes a payroll tax cut and corporate bailouts to stimulate the economy. Meanwhile, in Detroit, in anticipation of trying to fight coronavirus, restores water and adds a moratorium to shutoffs. Here's a suggestion. Make it permanent moratorium. How about just giving people water in their homes?
Communism.
Crazy. Then, of course, the state would have control of the means of producing clean hands. All of Italy on COVID-19 lockdown and suspends all mortgage payments. Yeah. The new chief of staff, Mark Meadows, has self-quarantined because of fears he may have contracted COVID-19 at the very moment the chief of staff he replaced was at CPAC saying that it was a hoax. Also from CPAC, Gates and Cruz now self-quarantined themselves. Even though Gates the other day thought it was a hoax, so much so that he was wearing... Do we have pictures of that?
Yeah.
Did we pull those pictures? State Department wants to list a white supremacist group, a terror organization. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau claims that the Fifth Third Bank pulled a Wells Fargo and opened fanked accounts for customers. That's always helpful. They're not only anticipating needs that you didn't even know you had, they're going ahead and charging you for them when you don't even realize that they're fulfilling that need.
It's the future.
Yep, there it is. It's like AI, but we still sort of sillily call it theft, I think is what we call it.
It's weird how AI doesn't seem to be saving regular people any money.
It will. Believe me. It will.
Seems to be better at the opposite.
So, folks, like I say, we'll get to this. I don't want to do this now. Like I say, we have primary day today. It is I don't know if it's like do or die. It may be somewhere between make or break or do or die in terms of Washington and Michigan. If Sanders loses Michigan and loses Washington, I mean, if Sanders gets swept tonight, it's really hard to see a path to victory? I don't know. I think, like, you know, if I'm the Sanders campaign, I want to do well enough to be able to stay in and have this debate with Joe Biden. And frankly, if I'm Bernie Sanders, I want to stay in and have that debate anyways, because the presidential platform has been, I think, for him, or the presidential campaign, I think for him, has always been a means in which to build a movement. And to have that debate, I think, would be helpful in that regard. We will have time, and I'm going to do my best to avoid talking about, you know, like, what is really a mystery, may be a little bit strong for me, but what has been a somewhere between a mystery to me and a genuine surprise, and maybe an understanding of Elizabeth Warren's desire not to endorse. Well, first of all, not to endorse Sanders. And frankly, for that matter, to endorse at all. And I have some thinking on that. We're, you know, on Friday, we're going to have Ryan Grimm on, a good person to talk to, I think, about this. So I may save those for then, but we'll see. I have a feeling tonight, after a couple of drinks, I might loosen up a little bit, and that's, you know, that's going to happen. But
you're going to be posting snake emojis by the end of the night.
No, no, no. I still have respect for Warren, and because I don't. It's the flip side of me really not having any sort of genuine personal feelings towards politicians, and I judge them really, you know, more or less like I do, you know, I don't know, a computer. There are certain inputs. You get certain outputs. They can do certain things. Some are more reliable than others. You know, et cetera, et cetera. I think that there's some clarity as to, her agenda. And I think to a certain extent, it is an extension upon my feelings about her skill set and maybe even desire to engage in public facing politics. And that's a, you know, or, you know, maybe you want to call it movement politics, however you want to call it. But we'll talk more about that in a bit, because there's one clip that I'm a little bit dubious again, but there is a legitimate mystery here. People keep alluding to it to me on Twitter, and I want to know. And even like the frame. Well, look, we'll talk about it in a bit. I feel like I'm Joe Biden, where it's like I'm just so overwhelmed by the all the information that I have to check out, and just like isn't that my time?
Mention the Donbass.
Isn't that my time? That's my time. I'm not going to go over. Of course I will. All right. But speaking of Joe Biden, he did an interview with Lawrence O'Donnell last night. It was also just sort of like, look, this is an interview. I can just tell you, there's no inside information here. I'm just looking at this as a former director and as someone who watches a lot of news. This is a set that has been constructed to make it look like Joe Biden has been president for 2 years. The lighting is much more yellow and moody than you will get in other things. The idea is to make it seem like he is in the, this is like a fireside chat type of situation, back from FDR on some level. I mean, just from a lighting perspective, more often than not, these things are more well lit, a little bit brighter when you see these interviews. The idea is also, I think they probably, the Biden people probably said, tone down the lighting a little bit. We don't want anything that looks too harsh. And, you know, look, this may work. You may be able to do this. You know, how many years was it the FDR was more or less immobile and they hid it from the U.S. public?
Slightly different media environment, though.
It's true. But also maybe less sophisticated in terms of their ability to manipulate these things.
Deep fake Joe through 4 years.
I think maybe all they're looking to do is 9 months. But here is Joe Biden talking about the Iraq war, he's asked. And look, we're going to then go to a clip, series of clips that Mehdi Hassan put together for The Intercept. We've played, I think, all of these clips in the past anyway, separately. But he just put one out that was, you know, the issue is not that Joe Biden has gaffes, although that's true. The issue is not that Joe Biden has lost a step, which I think is undeniable, certainly by the reporters who have covered him that have expressed it in, you know, off the record situations. But one of the issues is that he is a fabulist. I mean, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he doesn't know he's lying. He wants the truth to be something else. But I lived through this era. I knew where Joe Biden was on Iraq. Here he is telling a slightly different version of what happened in 2002, 2003, 2004.
Killed yesterday in Iraq. You say that your vote on the Iraq war was based on the president's, Bush's representations that this wasn't about going to war. It was about presenting a clear, at least, threat to Saddam Hussein. Bernie Sanders says, I saw right through that. I was right. I knew what George Bush was up to. When we look back on it, can we say that Senator Sanders' judgment about that was better than yours?
Look, the reason I voted the way I did was to try to prevent a war from happening because, remember, the threat was to go to war. The argument was because Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. So he said that I need to be able to get the Security Council to agree to send in inspectors to put pressure on Saddam to find out whether or not he's producing nuclear weapons. And at the time, I said, that's your reason. All right, I get it. That was the rationale was that's the way to not go to war, because I didn't believe he had those nuclear weapons. I didn't believe he had those weapons of mass destruction. And you may remember the debates we had after that period about when Colin said, anyway. So that was the rationale. Mm-hmm. What happened was we went in to
pause it for 1 second. When Colin said what he was talking about was Colin Powell went in front of the United Nations, held up a vial of talcum powder and said, you know, this is next, anthrax. Larry Wilkinson, who was Colin Powell's second, said that he knew going into that speech where the CIA director at the time, I can't remember his name now, was sitting right behind Colin Powell at the UN. He knew this was a crap show. He knew they were lying on behalf of the administration.
And you may remember the debates we had after that period about when Colin said, anyway. So that was the rationale. Mm-hmm. What happened was we went in, determined that they hyped what, in fact, was occurring. They didn't. There was no concrete proof of what he was doing. And they still went to war. And the irony of all ironies is the first thing that Barack Obama did when we got elected president and vice president was turn to me and say, end the war. Not a joke. You run the deal to bring out 150,000+ combat troops from Iraq. And I did. So, you know, the idea that I took the word of a president saying that he wasn't going to go to war and this was the way to avoid going to war was, in fact, a mistake. It was a mistake. I've acknowledged that 15 years ago. But the idea that Bernie Sanders' judgment on foreign policy is superior to mine, I'm anxious to debate him on that question.
Well, I you don't need to debate him on that question. You just did. You just did. And after that long filibuster, you swung all the way around and said, yes, it was a mistake. I did not have the same judgment of Bernie Sanders at that time. I'll tell you who else you didn't have the same judgment as. Nancy Pelosi, who also knew what you say you knew. There was no nuclear weapons there. There was no weapons of mass destruction. Nancy Pelosi, let's pull up her vote. Nancy Pelosi voted against that same resolution. Many people did. Not tons. 133 in Congress. Almost exclusively Democrats. I think there was probably one or two. I bet you, you know, Walter Jones from North Carolina at the time was one of those guys who might have voted against it. Biden voted yes. But there were others who said no. If Joe Biden really believed that. But here's the problem with what Joe Biden is saying. He's also lying that 15 years ago he said it was a mistake. The war was launched. Well, 15 years ago, first of all, was 2 years after the war had started. And the idea, though, that he thought that he was just voting to authorize, to leverage, to stop the war.
I was calling their bluff.
Yeah, I was calling their, well, what he was doing was, you know, the weapons inspectors went in. They looked at all the sites that the CIA had told them. They said, there's nothing here. Tell us where they are. Tell us where they are, they kept saying. Tell us where they are. And then after a couple of weeks, after I think it was maybe 6 to 8 weeks, the Bush administration just said, you know what? Just get out in 24 hours because we're going to bomb the hell out of everything. Sorry, couldn't find it. We don't want this to go on too much longer. It's going to be obvious we were lying. But let's go here. Mehdi Hassan has pulled the clips to see where Joe Biden was in 1998. And this is a clip of him talking to Scott Ritter, I believe it is, who was a weapons inspector, saying it's not in there. They don't have it. Now, 98 was a little bit earlier, obviously, before this. But then we'll see a clip of Joe Biden 4 months after shock and awe, when we've invaded the country, to see how much regret he has that the Bush administration went to war then.
It's pure misrepresentation. Then there's Iraq, where the former vice president says he only voted for the war because the Bush administration tricked him.
I made a mistake. I said it 14 years ago. I trusted George Bush to keep his word. He said he was not going to go into Iraq.
Except Biden was calling for war with Saddam Hussein in 1998.
The only way we're going to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and it's going to require guys like you in uniform to be back on foot in the desert taking the son of taking Saddam down.
He also says now that he opposed the Iraq war as soon as it started.
From the moment shock and awe started, from that moment, I was opposed to the effort and I was outspoken.
A complete fabrication. Here he is several months after the invasion began, praising both the war and George Bush.
Some of my own party have said that it was a mistake to go to Iraq in the first place. But the cost of not acting against Saddam, I think, would have been much greater. The president of the United States is a bold leader, and he is popular.
Again, Biden just makes stuff up.
5 months after shock and awe, 5 months after shock and awe, he is still saying that going to war was the right move to do. He was praising George W. Bush. I want to see that debate. But we don't have to. We just witness it. The largest foreign policy failure of this country in 50 years. And he was 100% wrong. And now he's lying about it after the fact. What more debate do you need? How much of what we're dealing with today is a function of that call by Joe Biden? I mean, give me a break.
Do you think there's any way to get this information out to people?
I'm not sure that people
can just say whatever he wants and people will believe him.
I don't know how much people care.
Oh, I think people care about the Iraq war. Trump ran partly on saying that he was against it. Like, people have lost their taste for empire in general, and the Iraq war is largely considered to be a mistake.
I think, but Donald Trump also, when he contemporaneously, was for the Iraq war. I mean, so that's my point, is that, like, Well, at least now he's saying the right thing. It's annoying. I just, I would.
It'd be nice if we didn't have all the fake candidates distracting from these actual issues with Biden for the last 8 months.
But it would have been nice, look, if you're going to interview the guy and the guy's going to make that claim, if you're going to ask the question, know the answer, is what I would say. Folks, I got some decent news for you. Actually, this is good news. Healthy, plant-based, non-toxic cleaning products, they work. And the good ones are actually more enjoyable to use. You don't have to worry that you're poisoning yourself or your kids or whatever it is. The problem is, where do you go? Who do you trust? How do you get this stuff? That's where Grove Collaborative comes in. Grove Collaborative is the online marketplace that delivers all natural home, beauty, and personal care products directly to you. Grove takes the guesswork out of going green because every Grove.co, it's Grove.co product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. I got to tell you, right now, obviously, in my household, my kids, they come into the house, they know immediately, wash your hands. And one of the first things I did when we started this regimen is I went on to Grove Collaborative, that's grove.co, and I bought multiple of those Mrs. Meyer's refillable things for the hand soap. So I got, like I said, maybe went overboard, 4 jugs, but it's delivered right to the house. And I got the rainwater one because I don't like the smells. But for those people who, for whatever reason, like things that smell nice, they have that too. They have the lavender. They have the verbena. I think the geranium. I can't remember what the other ones are. But for me, I'm strictly rainwater is about as smell as I want. But it's a great place for soaps, for cleaning things. They have a Grove concentrate cleaner. It's the only thing I will use now in my house, my apartment, I should say. And the guide is incredibly helpful that they have there as to what kind of products you're looking for. It's incredibly helpful. You can join over 2 million lifetime customers. They trust a Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier, healthier, cleaner, plus shipping fast, free on your first order. And for a limited time, when listeners go to grove.co/majority, that's grove.co/majority, you're going to get a free 5-piece cleaning set from Mrs. Meyer's and Grove. It's a $30 value. Go to grove.co/majority to get this exclusive cleaning offer. grove.co/majority. Check it out. Meanwhile, designed with measurements from millions of women, Third Love's bra styles are made to fit your life. They have over 80 bra sizes, but know that the only one that matters is yours. I am not a bra user. But we do. I do have a testimonial from our designated Majority Report bra user, and she writes, "The idea that I had 60 days to try out the bras drew me in. But I have to say, in the end, I don't think I've ever had a better experience buying clothing online, certainly not when it comes to bras. The fit finder worked like a charm. The choice of styles, amazing. Both the bras I ordered were a perfect fit. They're incredibly comfortable, they are cute, and they are subtle. I love them." There you have it, folks. This is the hands down the most comfortable bra you will own. Straps that won't slip, tagless labels, lightweight memory foam cups to mold to your shape. Plus, returns and exchanges are free and easy. And as our bra trier said, Third Love's perfect fit promise means that every customer has 60 days to wear it, wash it, and put it to the test. And if you don't love it, you return it, Third Love will wash it and then donate it to a woman in need. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find your perfect fitting bra. Get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off today. Lastly, VPN, it protects your privacy and security online, but this is what it will also do. It'll take your TV watching to the next level. Because a VPN basically hides your identity and your location and all of this data, you can use it to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. With ExpressVPN, you can binge shows like Doctor Who on UK Netflix. All you do is you use the ExpressVPN app to change your location to the UK. ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. You can choose from almost 100 different countries. That's a lot of different Netflix libraries, folks. Even Japanese Netflix. But it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. Hulu, BBC, iPlayer, YouTube, and more. ExpressVPN is ridiculously fast. There's never any buffering or lag. You can stream HD and no problem. ExpressVPN is also compatible with all your devices, your phone, your media consoles, your smart TVs, and more. Check it out, expressvpn.com/majority to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, protect yourself all in one place, expressvpn.com/majority. All of those links will be in the podcast description and the YouTube description. Quick break, be right back with Dave Weigel. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome Washington Post, the political correspondent, national political correspondent, Dave Weigel. Dave, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here in Langley and definitely not Caracas.
Right, exactly. There you go. Dave, I know this is very exciting to you because you get to say Macomb County today. And that is like one of those. It's like Waukesha, Macomb, right? And is there any other county in the country that is more of a bellwether than those two?
In a primary, it's a good question because last time, 4 years ago, Hillary Clinton actually won Wayne County, won Macomb, won Oakland. So that's Detroit, and that's the places where most suburbanites, frankly, the vote that started with white flight after the 60s, that's where a lot of the vote comes from. It's really about half the vote is going to come from those places, from Washtenaw, which is Ann Arbor, and then from Flint. Half the Democratic vote in the primary comes from there. That's about what it was last time. And so the margin Sanders is playing with.
Ooh. Hey, you know, let me call you
the suburbs by a bit more.
Hey, Dave, let me call you right back because we're getting a little hinkiness on our phone. I'll call you right back.
Oh, okay. This is a landline, so I'll
it's probably mine. All right. Sometimes maybe got to come up with a new.
This is David.
David, it's Sam Seder. We were just talking.
Saying that definitely was not interrupted while carrying out an international plot against one of America's foreign enemies. Continue.
What you were telling us, and this is interesting because this has been a dynamic that's been going on in this campaign we've seen. In 2016, Sanders won a lot of the rural counties, whereas Clinton won a lot of the sort of the more urban or suburban counties. And that's been sort of flipped a little bit for Sanders.
Well, so it has been. If you look at the states that have voted already, and I mean, this is like, I'm much happier predicting things after Super Tuesday because we've seen how demographics have moved around. Last time, Sanders did extremely well in rural areas, very well with white working class voters. And I think, and you know, no one likes to hear this in Sanders' electorate or in his campaign, I think there might have been some overrating of how much of that was support for him and how much of it was just opposition to Hillary. Because in Oklahoma and Minnesota, two states that Midwestern is fair to say about Minnesota, less about Oklahoma. In those places, his vote fell off a lot from last time. And one thing I noticed in the counties that border North Dakota, which has a party-run caucus today, less like the caucus where you sit in a room, more like a typical election. In the counties that border North Dakota, Sanders got about 25% of the vote. And he dominated those counties last time. He dominated North Dakota last time. So you take that to Michigan, a path for him to win this thing is to do better with black voters and about even or only a little bit worse with rural voters, and he's not on track to do that right now. And what I was saying, but when my phone line was absolutely not being interrupted by foreign interference, was that he has been struggling in suburbs, and the suburbs and the college towns in Michigan are going to cast probably half the vote.
Wow. Well, I guess. All right. So let's talk about how important, where does Sanders have his best opportunities tonight? We've got six states: Idaho, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, Washington.
Right.
I mean, presumably it should be Michigan and Washington, right?
Yeah. So Washington is like Minnesota in that it had a big caucus. It was actually the biggest state that had a caucus until the last year, and they switched the state from the caucus to a primary. Washington also votes by mail, and take us a couple steps back here. There might be a real crisis on Democrats' hands if a gigantic state was going to hold a caucus in the middle of the virus outbreak. That is not as much of an issue right now because the states moved to vote by mail. So if you are a reporter looking to talk to people outside the polls in Washington State, I'm sorry about that today. You're not going to find it. They're just dropping ballots in mailboxes. That'll take a while to count. And one thing I've noticed with Sanders chatter online is there's a lot of frustration. Just nothing seems to be going his way in a couple of respects, but he's been doing very well in these states with lots of mail balloting, like California, lots of late voting. It just takes forever to count them. So we'll probably get a sense of who's ahead in Washington tonight, but maybe not who won it, unless it's a blowout for one person or another. And then in Michigan, we will get slow results that will probably be decisive tonight in Michigan. But one thing I heard from folks in both campaigns is Biden did so well in states last week where he did not even spend any effort, any organizing, that if there's a similar just suburban walk to the polls like there was in Virginia or in North Carolina, then Biden could win pretty decisively. I mean, Bernie's the one who is once again in the position of having to make an upset.
Let me just go back to, you just said something about California.
Yeah.
What is happening in California? I mean, I know that Sanders what's happening with his lead there? Do we have a sense of like how the counting is going? I mean, I know what the numbers are specifically, but what is the trend? I mean, does it look like, I mean, right now it looks like he's up about 34%, Biden's 27%.
Yes. And so California is both really irritating and pretty transparent. So the state has a very generous ballot, early voting mail ballot process. You can drop a ballot in the mail on election day. And quite obviously, let's say you drop your ballot in the mail in Riverside and it's getting counted somewhere in Los Angeles, it's not going to be counted that night. So the state actually releases the totals of ballots remaining, although not by party. We know that there, according to the state, as of this morning, there are 2.9 million ballots uncounted.
Wow.
And some proportion of those are Republican, but let's say two-thirds of them are Democrat. You're going to have probably another 50% of the vote you just saw already counted added to this total. What has been happening as votes come in is that And it's very situational because, you know, one day there'll be a block of votes from right. Santa Cruz. One day there'll be some from the Bay Area. But since election night, Sanders has continued to hold a lead. He leads in all but 8 congressional districts by my last count this morning. That's pretty good. He leads in – there's 53 districts in the state. So 45 seats, he's going to get more delegates than anybody else. But the lead is less commanding than some of the exit polling suggested. He's up by 7 statewide over Biden. And Elizabeth Warren has been doing better as ballots are counted late. She looked like she was coming in third. Sorry, she looked like she was coming in fourth on election night. She's actually edged ahead of Michael Bloomberg, and that has actually gotten turned to the delegate position in a few more districts. So one dream scenario for Sanders, like a good dream scenario, that you heard some speculation about was if the moderates are so divided that they split the vote everywhere, he could win every delegate. Bernie could win every delegate in California. That's just not going to happen. He's going to end up with a majority of delegates pretty comfortably, but not enough likely to wipe out what happened on the rest of Super Tuesday. So if you're looking for the California results and hoping for him to maintain a gigantic Sanders lead, what's more likely is that the 7-point lead he has could stay the same or shrink a little bit. Still enough for the delegates, but like literally the Wisconsin primary will be underway by the time California finishes voting.
Right.
And it's I guess it's more annoying for campaigns than for journalists, but it's not fun for everybody else.
What? All right. So Michigan, I guess to a certain extent, we just have no sense. I mean, the polling in Michigan does not look good for Sanders.
Yeah.
And but the polling looked similar, I guess, going into Michigan last time. But it's a different year.
It is. And so one quirky thing about Michigan last time, it feels weird to use the word quirky to describe like democracy failure. But so in 2008, the Democrats got into this fight over the primary calendar, and Michigan and Florida both tried to leapfrog and frankly did the sort of thing that a lot of Democrats still want, which is a more diverse state that represents the modern party going first. The party punished them by saying, if you're that early, you're not getting any delegates, and they were sanctioning campaigns that spent time in the states. So in Florida, Democrats got on the ballot but didn't campaign. In Michigan, some Democrats didn't even get on the ballot. The result of all that is that there, in 2016, the last primary pollsters could look at was one where literally Obama was not running. It was just a Hillary versus uncommitted versus Dennis Kucinich contest.
Right.
And so pollsters had a bad model. They were more wrong than they'd been in any state, really, in that decade. I mean, it's actually, if you go to the pollsters themselves at Epic MRA or Mitchell, Nate Silver had some analysis at the time. It was just as wild a miss as you can get. And another factor that's screwed things up for them is this, at the time, the polling, it's a bit of like a data Ouroboros, because the polling suggested that Hillary was going to win Michigan decisively. So tens of thousands of moderate voters who said at that time, I'm a moderate. It looks like Hillary's going to win the Democratic nomination. I don't want Trump to win. I'm going to go vote for Kasich in the Republican primary, because you can do that in Michigan. That's a pretty big factor. I mean, the same thing in New Hampshire. It's a reason Klobuchar did so well, better than polling was suggesting, because a lot of moderate independents came out and said, I heard about her on TV the other day. I would vote for her. And so with all that, the polling is probably less bad this time. And if it's only half as bad as it was last time, it will – then Biden is on his track to win. If it's – let's say the error is 10 points, the average of polls, Biden would win by about 10 points. But at the same time, I've saw this while I was in the state over the weekend. The Sanders campaign has a gigantic operation it has been building for months. The Biden campaign is very much playing catch-up and basing things on endorsements, on local Democrats, on the governor, on the lieutenant governor. It's just kind of trying to mobilize this shock campaign. And part of that campaign, and it's running in Michigan, which maybe you've seen, it literally just plays footage of Super Tuesday states being called for Biden with the implication that, look, this thing's basically over. Let's just end it right now. And criticizing Bernie Sanders for going negative on him as if – and they're trying – there's a little bit of projection here that, as if every Democrat is like Joe Biden. They just want Bernie to go away so they can start running against Trump.
I mean, there's definitely, I think, I think that's what they're banking on some level. What other states are we looking at that maybe Sanders has a chance to keep it close or to sneak one out? Any?
Yeah, so there's six states. We talked about Washington and Michigan. There's also Idaho. There's North Dakota. There's Missouri. There's Mississippi. Now, last time, North Dakota and Idaho, Sanders won both. He won Idaho by a landslide. Last time, he very, very narrowly lost Missouri. And actually, the entire Hillary margin for Missouri basically came from how big she won the city of St. Louis. She was doing pretty poorly the rest of the country. And so, again, like, it's possible to get too drunk on pessimism for Bernie Sanders, given how things are going. But if the votes were shaking out the same way they did last week, Missouri would be very tough for him to hold on to that 49% he got last time. Mississippi is not good for him. He basically has given up on the state, which is very bittersweet. I mean, Mississippi was a state Sanders has been citing for years as one the party needs to invest in to prove that you can win anywhere, and he's pulling out of it in the primary. And North Dakota and Idaho are, like Washington, states that have changed from traditional caucuses to different processes. And in North Dakota, it's firehouse caucus is kind of, I don't know where that term came from, but it's basically, hey, the party is running this election, but you can show up and drop a ballot off and walk out. It's not like a main caucus. Same, Idaho is a straight-up primary. And so Sanders lost already several states that switched from caucuses to primaries. He lost Maine and Minnesota. These are going to be more competitive. I think on a good night for him, he's going to win Idaho and North Dakota. On a great night, he adds a Michigan to it. The rest are much heavier. On a great night, he adds Washington, maybe Michigan. The rest are, I think, heavier carries.
I see. Okay. And so a great night, Idaho, North Dakota, Michigan, and Washington. A good night, Idaho, North Dakota, Michigan,
and maybe Washington.
So, So like in terms of, let me ask you to sort of predict. It's Wednesday now, and somehow we got the results in, and Michigan is, he ekes out, Michigan, wins in Idaho, wins in North Dakota. Is there any question that he wouldn't continue on to, at the very least, go to the debate?
No question at all. And one thing you've seen from Sanders' own campaign, much more from his supporters online, is a sense that the rallying around Biden is being done to protect a nominee who's just not that good at campaigning or expressing himself at locking this up before voters notice. I mean, there's a little bit to that. In Iowa, in New Hampshire, places I spent lots of time in,
I would say,
where people saw Biden the most, he lost voters because he had kind of middling, sometimes rambling town hall appearances. He was really blown off the stage by people like Elizabeth Warren, like Kamala Harris, like Cory Booker, even people who didn't make it to the caucuses. So people who saw them at a very exposed length were not that impressed. And so there's a sense by the Sanders world that, look, if it looks like he's just rolling through these primaries because the party leaders want him to, we have a chance to warn people what a general election would be like in a debate. And again, I don't think that's crazy. There have been debates that really rattle confidence in the poll leader. And this would be a debate that is happening days before the second biggest primary date on the calendar so far. It's, you know, primaries in Ohio, Florida, Illinois, and Arizona. And once everything has a downside for Sanders at this point, right, those are all states that have lots of early voting. So the dream scenario for Sanders is winning so convincingly a debate and Biden looking so bad that Sanders would still need to overcome a big locked-in early vote, and that is probably leaning for Biden, certainly in Florida. I mean, Florida is another state that Biden is returning to this week. We're not sure if Sanders is ever going to get back there.
Well, and I mean, look, we saw Michael Bloomberg basically flush $500 million down the toilet in the course of like 45 minutes in a debate, right? I mean, that was basically it. It was gone. And Biden's investment is obviously not in dollars. It's people's investment in the idea that he's the guy who's going to win. He was associated with Obama, et cetera, et cetera. This is going to be the first time that he's going to be sitting, apparently, on a sort of debate stage, right? They're going to try and make it more of like a town hall. I imagine that if there's ever a time for Bernie Sanders to say, like, I don't need your stinking rules, I would imagine it's going to be there. I'm not sure exactly what that would mean. But so let me ask you this. Bernie loses in Michigan. Maybe it keeps it close in Washington, keeps it close in Idaho, loses badly in Mississippi, keeps it close in Missouri. I mean, let's just say he wins none of those. He just keeps it close.
Yeah.
There's no blowout. Maybe Michigan's a little bit more of a blowout. He's still going to stay in to this debate, isn't he?
Till the debate, yes. It is very hard to imagine the campaign abandoning things. And look, I mean, even Fauci here, the campaign manager, was retweeting this video this morning of Biden getting into it with an NRA guy at a factory. Honestly, as confrontations between Biden and voters go, and this is a weakness for Biden, he has a healthy ego. He gets very irritated when somebody disagrees with him. As those go, this is not one of the worst ones. I mean, he's basically taking a position that most Democrats share, which is, you know, like, don't tell me that the Second Amendment means you can own whatever gun you want. But it was very telling, I thought, that Faz retweeted that. And it's sort of a hint that, look, if we think this guy who has struggled and, you know, in order for him to have a good debate in South Carolina, the bar had to be lowered several miles below the surface of the earth. They think they can take him apart in that. They have a chance to do that. Why wouldn't they? I mean, Sanders is a better performer in these situations, in town halls, than Biden is. And you probably saw over the last couple of days the Sanders people talking about the negotiations for the debate format and really accentuating that Biden would prefer to have this be a town hall format where they're seated. I don't think the seated thing itself is crazy. Although these were both candidates who like to take seated questions by getting up and walking around the stage. So I don't know why that's part of the negotiation. But they're clearly looking at it saying, okay, even if things are bad, we're going to get another chance for voters to see these candidates and say, look, who do you actually trust to carry the ball all the way to Milwaukee into the general election? I mean, this is a point they can correctly say that Cory Booker and Julian Castro and other candidates were making about Biden, not even very subtly. I mean, I think the funniest one still is Tim Ryan, the congressman from Ohio, accidentally calling a Bloomberg he accidentally called a Bloomberg reporter thinking he was a donor and just started unloading how Biden was losing it, and then said he didn't mean that, and then endorsed Biden. So
wait a second. Whoa. Is there audio of that?
There's not audio. Oh. This is a Bloomberg story from a couple months ago, because it was in New Hampshire that Ryan realized that he had done this. But that is probably the most mask-off version of this, where you had a candidate who was running pretty explicitly on I'm a young, sharp guy and Biden is not, admitting this to somebody and then walking it back and then not that long afterwards just endorsing Biden.
Right. All right. Well, so with all that said, let's just shift a little bit to the last candidate who dropped out, because, in my mind, the debate is a potential event that could take place that could change the trajectory of the race. There was only one other event that could have happened this week, right after Stupor Tuesday, and that would have been an endorsement from Elizabeth Warren, in my estimation. I don't know, maybe there was something else that could have happened, but, you know, short of like, you know, some act of God. And she has, at least for now, declined to endorse. But I would imagine every day that goes by, regardless, endorse Biden, endorse Sanders, every day that goes by, her leverage and the value of that endorsement seems to me drops, right?
I think so. And look, I think that Sanders is not somebody that Liz Warren has clashed with as much as Biden in the past. And so I made like a little analysis of what she might do here that I think some people read as endorsement of what she would do. It wasn't that at all. But Elizabeth Warren enters negotiations wanting something and then leaves them when she gets it. And it is not clear what she would get from a Sanders endorsement unless she thought Sanders could win. It is clear what she would get from staying neutral, which is basically what she was getting at the end of the 2016 primary, which Hillary Clinton was aware but not aware enough of her problems on the left. And Warren had a voice, not the loudest voice, but a voice in suggesting appointments, not the big ones that you read about, like Treasury Secretary, but under that, just lobbying and saying, here's how you should form the government. She was a senator with a vote who could, you know, veto effectively some of those choices. I think that is what she wants If the choice is between endorsing a Bernie Sanders, the campaign that will lose, and endorsing a Biden campaign or letting a Biden campaign win so that she can lobby for appointments, I think that's the path she'll go down. And so I'm being kind of blasé here about the chances of Sanders winning. But there is some bitterness, and there is the sense by the Warren people that Sanders was never going to win this nomination anyway. Their view of her running was that he was going to end up faithfully in the position he is now, which is even in a one-on-one contest with Joe Biden, he's made too many enemies among Democratic leaders and Democratic voters to get to 50%. So they don't think her vote is worth as much as even Sanders people think it is. And there are people who get in guns a-blazing even when a candidate looks like they might lose because they believe in the cause. And I don't think that describes her. I think she believes more in what you do when you get power. And for her right now, unless Sanders has a very good night, that power might not ever get to Sanders.
Now that seems a rational explanation to me. But let me ask you this, your sense of this, because, you know, I mean, to me, it's a bit of a mystery because what does she think that she's going to be able to deliver to Joe Biden? Because, I mean, look, right. I mean, here's the thing. A lot of Warren supporters, you know, maybe the ones that were remaining were Joe Biden's people anyways, right? Maybe the ones that, like, it seems to me, I don't know what percentage of, let's say Bernie Sanders is, stuck at 30%, right, of the party.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that, like, 75% of those, maybe 65% of those are, Warren is their second choice. And... Mm-hmm. That I mean, my sense is that a lot of those people are just going, wait, what? Like, we thought you were, like, we were in this progressive front. You know, Sanders might have been my first choice, but you were my close second choice. Like, what does Elizabeth Warren think that she's going to be able to deliver? I mean, if I'm Joe Biden, I'm saying, like, you and what army?
But deliver, that's a good question. I think that is how she's looking at it. He's not in a look at, and Sanders might have the same problem. I mean, if Sanders does very badly over the next couple of weeks and he tries to negotiate with Biden, Biden can tell him to pound sand because he will be on track to win a clear majority of delegates on the first ballot convention.
Well, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about...
Oh, I know what you mean, yeah. I'm just saying it's like no one has a great... No one is sitting in one of these states with a pile of delegates and or a key endorsement that could shift things and saying... You can't win without me. I'm not sure if she's in that position. I don't think anyone's in that position. I think the turnout James Clyburn was, and nobody else. So the point of all that is, I think that it is less that she will be owed things, is that she will reestablish her relationship with Biden, which was not that warm in the Obama years. She preferred to work with Biden with the president than with Joe Biden, but portray herself as somebody who knows everything about the intricacies of finance, and basically, right. I mean, Biden does not run around defending the bankruptcy bill. I mean, the general Biden pattern is to take credit for everything that went right, and awkwardly not apologize for things that went wrong. But I think it is to go in there and say, I'm an important voice who is not working against you, and you should give me the. You should listen to me, at least heed me on these lists of nominees I'm going to suggest for lower roles in the administration. And again, that seems very wonky and boring, and that is like where she's comfortable.
I mean, No.
I think so we don't know what Biden's headspace is going to be like. I mean, if he's going to, we don't really don't. I mean, I think there's already some worry that he might look at who endorsed him and say, I get along with Amy Klobuchar and support her and as a vice presidential nominee, even though she'd bring nobody from the left back to the table, right? So we don't know how he's thinking. I'm trying to puzzle out how she's thinking.
But that's my point is that if that's how she's thinking, why wouldn't she endorse Biden?
Yeah.
Like if you thought.
Why wouldn't she endorse right now? Because I think she has less credibility with the left as she jumps in. I mean, now the thing about her, too, she noticed, I think, over 4 years that staying neutral in 2016, which actually was she was one of the few people in the Massachusetts delegation who stayed neutral in the Hillary Bernie race. Staying neutral got her a little bit with Hillary. It got her nothing with Sanders. So the Hillary campaign was indeed talking to her. She got meetings with her. She had, was submitting ideas for who Hillary could appoint. Whereas Sanders lost, so he couldn't offer anything there. And Sanders supporters, even in her state, would be angry for years, saying it was such a close race. You know, you could have delivered Massachusetts to Bernie. I'm not one of those people who says, oh, if people are mean to you online, it's their fault if the candidate, for what the candidate does next. Like, campaigns are mean.
Right.
Candidates should have the ability to stand up to this stuff. And people have been absolutely brutal making fun of everything from, you know, Joe Biden's, you know, son's employment history to whether he can finish a sentence. And he is not one thing that I think encourages Democrats about him is he's not seemed like a score-settling type of guy. He does not seem like Donald Trump. But her recent experience is that the establishment candidate, if they fall over the finish line, listen to her. And the left-wing candidate, even if he wins, which Sanders is not in the position of doing, doesn't give her that much. I mean, she was at the very end of this campaign. I don't think it – I think much less than the podcasters being mean to her, much less than that, the decision by Sanders to kind of go for a knockout in Massachusetts and have some campaign events, which didn't even work because Joe Biden won the state.
Right.
I think that strategically made sense for him. I mean, he was going to do better if she knocked out of the race, but it was pretty typical of the way they view things differently. I mean, she is a let's build the biggest group of alliances possible and negotiate the heck out of something, and he is a let's overwhelm them with our numbers. And if you're looking at it right now, the let's build a coalition, even if we're not that great at campaigning side, the Biden side, is doing better than Bernie Sanders' let's overwhelm them with new voters side.
I agree. I'm just thinking in terms of like leverage. It's the end of the race. Bernie Sanders has lost. He has conceded. Warren and Sanders shows up. And if I'm Joe Biden, I'm looking at Bernie Sanders' ability to raise money, his ability to mobilize people. And if I'm Joe Biden, I'm looking at Elizabeth Warren and saying, like, all your people that you had, they either voted for me anyways, for the most part, or you have now alienated them because they realize that you're not really part of what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess like that's the only
thing.
Like, I mean, I understand like her sense of like, and if it's the other thing, it's like if she already knows that she's trying to keep her powder dry because she wants to go to Joe Biden and say like, you know, let me appoint, some of your Treasury people, like, why not then endorse Biden? Like, what does she think she's going to lose? But that
no,
she
you might be poking all the right holes in this theory. I mean, I'm describing how Warren has done this in the past, but there's nothing that would prevent Biden from winning and saying, all right, I'm going to appoint the. I'm going to go walk around downtown Wilmington and the first 20 bankers that come out of these buildings, I'm going to put them in my Treasury Department. Nothing's stopping that. I just think Biden, if he wins this nomination, is unlike most people who will have won it because he ran a campaign that was losing everywhere and was resuscitated because Democratic voters wanted somebody who was electable. But it's a kind of weird, shaky, ad hoc coalition. So I think if she can negotiate her way into that, but she might get nothing. That's true. But she might get nothing by endorsing Sanders. And I don't think the grudge is that much bigger where she'd endorse Sanders and Sanders loses. But I'm not sure if people notice what was done at the last minute for these people. I think she'd have less bargaining power though if she, let's say, I mentioned the primaries next week. Let's say she flew to Ohio the day before that primary, endorsed Biden, and he won that primary by 20 points. I don't think that'd be as helpful because she'd have even more alienated people. And right now, the people who are most furious with Warren for not endorsing Sanders, they're mostly isolated on Twitter, and that is a universe that the Biden people could either ignore or make fun of, maybe to their long-term detriment. I mean, I have noticed them getting a lot more kind of cocky and punchy in the last few days.
I guess my experience has been just like a lot of people who are not like, you know, politico-y type of people. People who are supportive of Sanders, but also supportive of Warren. I've just had obviously this is anecdotal, but I've just had a lot of people who've like just been like, I don't understand what's going on. Why isn't she endorsing? Like, as if it was just like sort of obvious that she would. just like it would have been obvious that Sanders would have endorsed her. And I try to explain, like, I think she's mad about Massachusetts. And people are like, what? Like, for you and I, you know, we've been doing this long enough where we realize, like, oh, sometimes people get their feelings hurt and decide to change the course of American history. But I don't think normal people actually sort of perceive that. Like, they're like, what? No, there has to be something else going on here. And I can see that maybe she thinks that she wants this leverage with Biden, but I don't know why she wouldn't then endorse Biden now and get this whole thing over with, because I don't think that she's going to have any more, you know, the leverage that she supposedly gets from the left. I think there's going to be less of that than there is, than there would have been, frankly.
But I don't know. I mean, like, I think I'm not sure if we'll discuss it now. I think, again, the only model she has is last time, where she did have leverage with Hillary Clinton, but it was the leverage of somebody who had never run for president in the first place and who everyone on the left liked. And there are people there. But the left is so hard to define, as Warren's campaign found. I mean, she had basically kind of at her height when she was doing the absolute best, she still had the biggest support from this sort of bourgeois left coalition, with more education, whiter than the Democratic base, et cetera, whiter than the Sanders base. I mean, he always was, even when he was losing badly, was lapping her with Latino voters. In terms of the kind of intelligentsia, I mean, she never was the candidate of Jacobin. She was the candidate of the Nation and Mother Jones and stuff like that. And that is, frankly, the left that the Democratic establishment understands. I mean, they really do, and I think in a risky way, minimize the younger, more left-wing wing of the party. They just don't understand the DSA wing. They don't know what to make, and they think that they can maybe try to co-opt them down the line, but they don't think they're electorally important, where they do think that the factions Warren is most popular with are important. It's weird. I don't know how they're going to figure it out. I'm just telling you why. No, I was not surprised that Warren stayed neutral.
All right. So last question. And we saw this week Booker and Harris. Harris is being featured, it seems like to me, in Michigan quite a bit. And, one wonders if that's, sort of an audition. I imagine she's perceiving it that way. What have you started to hear anything about how people are assessing how coronavirus, the COVID-19, may impact the general?
Oh, that's a good question. It's already affecting how the campaigns work. I mean, I report from the road a lot, and I was going to be in Florida by tomorrow morning, and I'm not now because there's going to be, I think, one Biden rally Thursday, but there has been downsizing of other candidate activity. There was going to be a AFL-CIO forum in Orlando I was going to finish up at on Thursday night. There's not going to be one now. I think the biggest tell, frankly, about how this is affecting the campaign is that the Trump campaign had set out on this mission of holding big rallies in states that were holding Democratic primaries, and they're not doing that anymore. They're not saying we're not doing that because we're scared of the virus, but the reality speaks for itself. I mean, they went from and it is, if there was no virus, it is very, very easy to see how they would have rented some space in Detroit. The president would have spent 2 hours making fun of Joe Biden's crowds and et cetera, et cetera. He didn't do it. I mean, they haven't planned anything for next week in Ohio or Florida yet. So it's already affecting the – this is a way, ironically, that's probably helped Biden, because Biden is not a candidate who's going to get big turnout around. He's simply not. It's part of the spin. I mean, I was talking to Klobuchar when I was in Michigan, and she was just bragging about how, well, you know, Biden's voters don't go to rallies. They're Democrats who know what they believe in, and they come out and vote for him election day, et cetera. Like, he doesn't need big rallies and doesn't count on big rallies, even for voter registration. And Sanders does, and Trump does. So it is a to the extent it stops people from going to these rallies. I mean, it screws up how a campaign organizes them. I mean, just anecdotally, things that are not campaign events, I've seen people organize things and then struggle to get a crowd at them. I mean, if you were a campaign advance team, it takes thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars to put on a real event. The malt boxes, invite the media, the staging, the mics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, rent the space. Like, do you want to rent a space for 5,000 people and only 1,000 show up because they're scared?
Right.
So it is having cascading effects that we have only begun to understand. And I mean, it's something honestly I need to dig a bit more into. But look, it's the same reason the campaigns are not like, here's how we avoid assassins on the trail. They're not saying, here is how we're dealing with this virus that is scaring everybody. They're kind of shy about talking about it. But if it unfolds as it's unfolding, I think it is mostly harmful for Trump and Sanders.
I couldn't agree more. I'm willing to bet right now that you're going to get at least a couple of Biden people are going to tell you off the record, this is the best thing that could have happened to Joe Biden, because now we
I think so.
Well, now we have an excuse not to have rallies. Now we have an excuse not to have big audiences for a debate. We were hoping that we could get Joe Biden to do two events a week. Now we only have to do one, and he's doing it because he cares about the people. As opposed to he's just, you know, needs a nap or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's, you know, and I'm being a little bit flip here. And of course, like, you know, there's going to be if what appears to be, sort of in our future happens, it's going to be a horrible tragedy. But I think from the perspective of just sort of this analysis, I think this is, you know, never mind what it's going to do the economy and the implications of that relative to the election. But just from a practical standpoint, this is, you know, this is basically like a rolling snow day for Joe Biden on some level. Like, we're not going to have to do this stuff. And, you know, this is and frankly, it hurts Donald Trump because, you know, you put this guy in front of like, you know, a podium and it's just snooze fest.
No, absolutely. And I think it is going to help him in the short run. In terms of how people actually vote is what I think everyone is more worried about beyond who the candidate is, because there is a lot of early voting in the next couple states. There is not much early voting, none really, in Pennsylvania, in states that vote later in the calendar. And you saw even in California, places that have a ton of early voting, people were still showing up on Election Day in lines for hours. Right. You know, you only need to think of a few loud open mouth coughs in line for a scene from Contagion to begin to risk itself, right? For people to just get not just sick of standing in line for 2 hours, but to wonder if it's worth it. I don't think that there is much. Now, given the self-selected population of people who do vote, who do wait until Election Day to vote, I think it's still a much smaller problem than just, you know, economic system in which poor people work during Election Day and can't go out and cast a ballot. That's probably a bigger problem, but it is going to have some slashback effects.
Dave Weigel, thank you so much. Appreciate your time today. Tell the entire directorate and secret division that you work in, thank you for giving us access to you. And of course, we'll let you go back into deep cover.
Yeah, and it's I am angry with the company for giving me sinuses and allergies right now. I would have thought they would have cured that by this point. I don't know what my tax dollars are paying for, but I'm sure, through here. So thanks for having me on.
I'm sure that's just a cover. Probably incredibly healthy right now, but he's got to play it up like as part of his travel. Dave Weigel, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.
Sorry, bye.
Well, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. You know, look, the well, obviously want Sanders to do as well as possible tonight. But the debate is going to have an incredible amount of the implications of this debate are going to be really, really big. Because, you know, one of the concerns that people have, and it does feel to me like we have the ideological differences have all shook out, at least in the context of the Democratic primary. I think there's probably still some votes that you can reach by saying, like, you know, Joe Biden, NAFTA. But I feel like to a certain extent, there is a momentum to, like, if we can resolve this, let's resolve this. And if everybody is telling us that Joe Biden is the guy to win, then he's the guy to win. The only thing that could slow that roll is for the first head-to-head debate and everybody watch and Joe Biden shows up and he can't do it. Not literally can't do it, but people, I mean, who knows? Certainly, Mike Bloomberg, there is, I think, very little controversy over the fact that had Mike Bloomberg not been essentially filleted on that debate stage, this would be a very different race right now. I think, you know, I'm not saying he would have won, but I think that, like, he would have, he could still be in. Biden would not have this commanding lead. He would not have gotten those endorsements. That debate really changed things. This next debate Sunday could very well have the same impact. It will certainly, the stakes will be even higher. I mean, I'll tell you what's going to happen right now. Sanders does not win any of these states that we went through. Or he wins, let's say, I don't know, Idaho.
North Dakota. Come on, guys.
There's going to be this sense that you're going to hear, this is all but over. Why is Sanders staying into this? Why even have this debate? People are sick of the debates. That's what you're going to hear.
You're hurting the nominee.
Yeah. You're hurting the nominee. This is like 2016. You know, when's Comey going to come out with a letter, et cetera, et cetera. There's going to be 5 days of that. If Sanders takes Michigan, or he takes Washington and he comes close in Michigan and he takes one or two of those other states, if it's a split, then that debate is going to be, there's going to be a lot of tension on that debate. There's really not going to be a rationale to say, you know, right now, Sanders is, what is he down now? Like in terms of delegates?
Like 100?
Okay, so it's 16.8 to 14.5 or 4.
That's so close.
I mean, there's still 60% of the delegates out there right now. And after tomorrow night, there will still be you know, 50% of the delegates out there. And if it's near tie, so we'll see.
Yeah, let's let the rest of the country vote.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that if I think the question is, though, is, you know, if he's in contention, get to that debate and we'll take it from there. But ladies and gentlemen, I'll tell you where we're going to take it here. We're going to take it into the fun half. And then later we're going to take it all the way to
the White House?
No, well, the primary tonight. So, I don't know. I don't know where I was going with that. Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you are supporting the free show, and you get it free of commercials. And then we give you extra content. And then we give you all sorts of, like, little tiny bonuses once every 6 months or something. I don't know. I'm trying to be honest. Maybe once every 3 months, I would say. We're going to ramp it up, but
they've been getting some things there lately.
Oh, definitely. It's just that, you know, things are so crazy right now that we're just like, we're reacting. Believe me, I'm bouncing around. I know I'm not sleeping, any of that stuff. I'm just trying not to, like, you know, keep eating as a way of staying awake. That's the hardest part. That's why I had to give you all those cookies, because I'll just like energy. So jointhemajorityreport.com is where you go, ladies and gentlemen, to become a member. And also sign up for the AM Quickie. People are loving it. AMQuickie.com. 6 minutes in the morning, you will know everything that you should know about late last night or about today going forward. I mean, you will be in the know, and it's so convenient. It really should be called the AM Convenient, but that, not so good a title. I don't know. AM Convenient, if you want to call it that.
I don't think
with a
so.
Q.
Quonvenient?
I don't know. I'm just...
I think there's too much ideation going on
yeah.
for this bitch.
Too much. Exactly. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Joining me tonight for our coverage, in addition to Bobby Big Wheel... Aaron Kleinman, right? I can never get his handle right. But Nomaki Konst will be joining us in studio And you can check out the Noma Key Show at patreon.com, the Noma Key Show, or youtube.com, the Noma Key Show. Nomiki Konst will be with us. Check that out. Also, tomorrow night will be TMBS night, because tonight is not TMBS night, because it's another frickin' primary night, if you can believe it. So check that out. Patreon.com/TMBS or YouTube.com, The Michael Brooks Show. On that show will be somebody we don't know.
We have some guests.
Some guests. I'm sure they'll be interesting, intriguing guests. But speaking of which, what's happening on the Antifada, Jamie?
I'm so glad you asked. So this week on the Antifada, we speak with some striking grad student instructors from UC Santa Cruz about the wave of wildcat strikes currently spreading across the UC system. We talk about what they're striking over, the cost of living adjustment, how it links up to the wave of labor struggles happening in this country, and why they had to go against the bureaucracy of their own union. I think it was a pretty good conversation. That's out tomorrow. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Also, all three of us appeared recently on a podcast called The Insurgents and had a good conversation analyzing some of the primary results and how the Bernie Sanders movement fits into the larger fight for socialism. So check that out, too, folks. We tweeted it, so you can find it that way.
Matt.
Yeah, coming up next on Literary Hangover is The Widow Ranter. It's a play by Aphra Behn from 1689. It's about Nathaniel Bacon's rebellion in Virginia. But we're going to use it. It's not very historically accurate, so we're going to mainly talk about colonial Virginia and how they basically instituted and helped reify gender and race in the 1700s. Like, for instance, a lot of the free speech issues, like a lot of the early libel laws, were basically to tell women to shut up and stop slandering men. And also, we'll just stop that. I'll plug the rest of it next time. So Literary Hangover, patreon.com/literary hangover.
Folks, see you in a fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27, 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird.
No way!
Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.